Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. My first guest today is Dr. Hayley Ponsford, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. The topic is ADHD and eating habits.
With my expertise as both an eating disorder consultant and a neurodevelopmental consultant, I often get asked to see these young people who are very complex, where it's very difficult to work out and tease out what's happening one or the other. But once you can then, you know, if you can then assess and work out whether they do have ADHD and then successfully treat that, then again, the eating disorder can then improve.
Then something very different.
Bit of magic, isn't it? You know, you set out on the walk and all you're planning to do is go from one place to another. But it feels like while you're doing it, you put the world to rights and maybe some of the things that you're worried about, you put them into perspective.
Matt, all right, is a keen walker and a keen campervanner. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. Dr. Hayley Ponsford is a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and the topic is ADHD and eating habits. However, the first question I asked her was, what is the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist?
Oh, I get this asked all the time. People are very always confused with this. So,
I've never been novel in anything I do, so there's no reason why I should start now. Yeah.
No, it's a really good question. And I think it really helps clear up really understanding the sort of differences of the job. So a psychiatrist is a medically trained doctor. So I went to medical school, trained as a general doctor, and then I went into specialist training in mental health. And then I went into specialist training within child and adolescent mental health. A psychologist does a psychology degree. And then often when you see someone clinically, so someone who might work in the health service who's a psychologist, they will then have done further training in clinical psychology. So we both have titles of doctor, but I come from a medical background, having gone to medical school, whereas a psychologist comes from a psychology background and then does training in clinical psychology.
Okay, and both can be called doctor?
Absolutely, yeah. Just as you can be a doctor if you, I don't know, I've got a PhD in fish or
that was
plants.
That was what I'm getting at. So a psychologist has a PhD?
Not necessarily a PhD. They'll have a doctorate in clinical psychology. So they do a sort of further bit of training to do that. But yeah.
Very fine. All right. Let's crack on with the topic ADHD sufferers. And one thing that I really thought is that people can, particularly people of my generation, kind of dismiss it almost as not a real and serious thing. But I just like to very much put it on the table that I have friends. Well, work colleagues actually who have children that suffer from this. It is a real and serious thing and not something to be dismissed in my experience, and I'm sure in yours as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think the difficulty is that everyone has attention difficulties. You know, we all struggle sometimes with attention. And sometimes people then think, well, I've got attention difficulties. I don't have ADHD. But ADHD is a neurodevelopmental condition. It's something that's present throughout someone's life. And it will have a significant impact on their ability to be able to do things at school, do things at home, and do things at work. And there's a very sort of strict criteria for a diagnosis of ADHD. And I think what's happening now is that people are just more aware of the condition and more people are seeking help, recognizing that they're struggling with these difficulties and wanting to find out what's going on. For me, it's maybe slightly easier than maybe for adult psychiatrists because I see children. So I've seen, you know, children from a very young age. So I'll have a very clear developmental history that they've had these difficulties for some time. But I can understand why that there's some, I suppose, confusion or worry from the public that this isn't a real condition. But I can certainly say that the young people that I see and I work with, we make a big difference in what they're able to do, which has been brilliant, really, really good.
And with that in mind, this is probably an unfair question. Do we have an idea of numbers of, you know, adults and children that suffer from this?
Yeah, so it's around sort of 5 to 7% of young people will have ADHD. And we often, and certainly in the UK, have been historically terrible at diagnosing it. So we're actually nowhere near diagnosing 5 to 7% of the population with this condition. So again, when people say, oh my goodness, there's an overdiagnosis, actually what's happened is there's been an underdiagnosis for a very, very long time. So there've been lots of people with this condition who just haven't been recognized. And now we're better at understanding it. People are better at coming forward and seeking help for it. So we are actually getting nearer to being able to diagnose the levels that we know are present. And with a lot of neurodevelopmental conditions, as you get older, those symptoms can improve. So often when you're very young, they can be very, very impactful. And as you get older, you might learn strategies and have improvements in your ability to manage those symptoms. You might go into industries or jobs that actually having ADHD symptoms are actually a plus point. So you're not seeing it as a significant impairment. So often what we see is actually ADHD rates in adults will reduce. But right. I'm not an adult psychiatrist and don't work with adults with ADHD. So I can't really comment too much on that aspect.
Sure. All right. So for the subset of people that, or children really, that we're looking at now, those kids with ADHD that affects their eating habits, is that a tiny subsection of this 5 to 7%, or is it quite common within that 5 to 7%?
I would say it's relatively common, and that's because there are a number of ways ADHD can impact on eating. So for some young people that I see, their ADHD kind of inattentiveness or hyperactivity means that they struggle to focus with eating. So when the family sits down for the meal, the child's distracted with wanting to do something else. They're kind of getting up. They're not really focusing on eating. So they're ending up not eating that much. So they can end up with a kind of nutritional deficiency because they're not eating well enough.
They just kind of miss the meal time. Right. This is eating time. And they're not really there.
And they're not really there. So they're kind of just wanting to go off and do lots of different things. So there's that aspect of it. There's also an aspect of ADHD. Actually, one of the commonest comorbidities with ADHD is obesity, which I think not many people know about. And so sometimes people with ADHD, they can really struggle to regulate their impulses around eating. So what happens is that they will gravitate maybe towards sweeter foods or kind of convenience foods and actually overeat rather than pausing and stopping. And we kind of understand that a bit because often people with ADHD will have slightly lower levels of dopamine in their brain. So they'll do lots of dopamine seeking behaviors and eating sort of sugary foods and do that will give you a little bit of a dopamine release, like a little dopamine hit. So they'll kind of be gravitated towards eating a little bit more. So actually, when we start understanding that and treating ADHD, we can kind of stabilize their eating, often leading to much better levels of concentration and focus.
So, I mean, certainly a trait of ADHD that I think a lot of people know about is this impulsivity. Mm-hmm. So let's do something on, you know, impulse. Let's do it now. So if you, and I think what you're saying is that that can sneak through into food habits. So, you open a packet of biscuits and you eat the lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think impulsivity with ADHD, I mean, I think one of the things is quite important, I suppose, to also understand is that there's different types of ADHD. So there's some people who have just a purely inattentive subtype, so they won't have so much of the hyperactivity or impulsivity aspects of ADHD. But for young people who have a more hyperactive and impulsive form of ADHD, there can be lots of impulsivity. And that might be around food. It could be around relationships and emotions. It could be around risk taking. So it's just really important that when we're seeing a family, and the work that I do is around, you know, understanding the whole picture. So really thinking about every aspect of how ADHD might be impacting on them. So we can, you know, work on how to improve that and think about how we can make some positive changes.
Yeah. Another thing that you I think you come across, well, certainly laymen might associate it with it, ADHD, quite intense emotions. Can that come across into how people approach food and eat different foods?
Yeah, so one of the sort of factors I have is that I work with children with ADHD, so neurodevelopmental conditions, but my background is also in eating disorders. So that's working with children and young people with things like bulimia nervosa or anorexia. And we also, well, certainly one of the things I'm interested in is understanding neurodiversity within that cohort of people. And when we're thinking about a condition such as bulimia nervosa, where there is this impulsivity and there can be emotional difficulties where people will use food or strategies to be able to manage that, that's a kind of conditional thing that I would also be kind of looking at.
Okay. There are other things that kind of trigger whether you're hunger or whether you're hungry or you're full. You know, in regular people, we eat a big dinner and then we feel full and we stop, or, you know, we haven't eaten for a bit, so we feel hungry. Do those sort of, and that's kind of a physical thing. Do those physical signals maybe not work in quite the same way with the ADHD people?
I don't actually know the answer to that question. So my understanding is that isn't a concern. So thinking around the kind of signals that we have that tell us when we're full or when we're hungry, it's more around our attention. So kind of where we're focusing on something or impulsivity around it rather than the sensation of feeling full or not feeling full. However, when we're thinking about treatments for ADHD, so for example, stimulant medication like methylphenidate, which is a very common medication that we use, a very kind of common side effect of that medication is appetite suppression. So that when a young person takes that medication, they don't feel hungry while the medication is active in their system. And so for those young people, that's sort of what you're describing can happen. So they take the medication in the morning, and while that medication is active in their system, they're just not getting that hunger signal. So right. They don't feel hungry, so they don't eat so much. And then sometimes when the medication wears off, they can then feel really hungry and overeat, or sometimes they still don't feel that hungry and then they end up losing weight. So one right. of the things that's very important for me is obviously monitoring children when we're using this medication to make sure that they're growing appropriately and that their hunger sensations are not being impacted by the medication.
Goodness. All right. So young people could have problems with food because they've got ADHD, and they could also have problems with food because of the drugs that they're getting to help them with the ADHD. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is not a simple task, is it, to help people?
No. And I think, you know, certainly my work at the London Psychiatry Clinic, you know, is around, you know, using my expertise. I've been a doctor for a very long time, 17 years. So, you know, I understand this condition. I understand the risks and the positives. And again, when people sort of say, oh, ADHD isn't a real condition, or ADHD isn't, you know, a particular problem, you know, the young people that I see, it impacts them very much. And they actually need a very skilled kind of clinician to have them support with all these different aspects. It's not quite as simple as saying, you don't focus on something, here's a tablet, see you later. There's actually lots of consideration. And we take a very holistic approach. We have to make sure that everything we're doing is in that child's best interest, that they're flourishing, that their family are supported, that the school are supported. So there's a lot of work that goes in supporting young people with this condition.
With that in mind, do you get situations where a young person, you know, their life could feel chaotic, or it could be chaotic because of ADHD, and then the eating is kind of one thing that they can control, so they might go down this route of restrictive eating to kind of gain some control because it's something in their life that actually they have total control over?
So we often see this pattern in young people with anorexia nervosa, where the control of eating is a sort of big factor in wanting to be able to manage their anxiety or their stress or you know, the other kind of emotion that they're struggling with. And so again, with my expertise as both an eating disorder consultant and a neurodevelopmental consultant, I often get asked to see these young people who are very complex, where it's very difficult to work out and tease out what's happening one or the other. But once you can then, you know, if you can then assess and work out whether they do have ADHD and then successfully treat that, then again, the eating disorder can then improve. So again, that's an area that I think is complex, but it's really important in supporting people with.
I've seen it, people that suffer from this on their plate, they don't like to mix food. Is that a texture thing? And do people become more susceptible to, because eating you've got taste. That's a big thing. And texture is a massive thing. You know, we like different textures in our food. Do people with ADHD kind of have sense things differently somehow, and have they're less worried or more worried about texture of food?
It's not a common it's not a common thing for someone to describe that with a, you know, with a young person with ADHD. So often around textures and food touching is often seen more in other neurodevelopmental conditions like autism. But just like, you know, anything can happen to anyone, you know, people without either condition can also not like their food touching or like certain textures and sensitivities. But usually, you know, again, I would be thinking more around a kind of an autism picture. And ADHD and autism can also coexist together. So if you have one neurodevelopmental condition, you're at a slightly higher risk of having another one. So autism and ADHD, ADHD and tics, ADHD and dyslexia. So there's lots of kind of crossover between these neurodevelopmental conditions.
So there's a lot going on here. Does this necessarily lead to eating what I would call bad food? I mean, food that isn't nutritious. I mean, so do you see some patients just wanting to eat loads of sweet things that just aren't good for them and kind of never touch a vegetable?
I would probably say, I mean, I see young people with a range of conditions, so anxiety, depression, you know, ADHD, autism, all sorts of different things. And I would also say, just in my general day-to-day life, that I think the whole population is gravitating towards more highly processed kind of food. So I think with young people,
that's a whole
ADHD,
other topic, isn't it?
Yes,
ultra processed foods and how we're all addicted to them.
I could definitely talk about that too, but I think with, you know, like I say, with young people with ADHD, yes, there can be a difficulty with impulse control, but I would say very typically, like any other teenager or young child, they're attracted to what is attractive. And the way that we often promote foods towards young people, with them being colourful and, you know, cartoony and exciting, and often not very nutritious, is not necessarily, I think, an ADHD difficulty. I think it's actually a population difficulty. Yeah. But there might be some increased difficulty with the impulse control with ADHD.
All right. Well, you have been talking about people with ADHD maybe moving towards a certain sort of food or having trouble eating food, whatever. Can it work the other way? Can a bad diet maybe lead to ADHD? Or is that a thing that one knows?
Yeah, so no, there's no evidence base that the diet or what you eat can lead to ADHD. There's certainly things that can make ADHD symptoms a little bit better. So there's some research in things like omega-3 and making sure that vitamin deficiencies aren't there. So things like zinc and iron. So if you can improve those, it can improve people's ADHD symptoms. So if a child is deficient in one of those things. But there's no particular kind of food type that will cause ADHD. There is some evidence based that highly sugared and E-number type foods, so ones that have been typically banned in the UK but are kind of creeping in as we've got more kind of American type sweets that are now being imported. For some young people with ADHD, that can make that worse. But for some kids with ADHD, they can eat sweets and E-numbers and be absolutely fine. So it's really much more down to an individual. But I would always say to families, if you have a child or any child, ADHD or otherwise, and they can have a very well-balanced diet with good levels of protein and carbohydrate, their concentration levels will improve. We want brains to be working really, really well. And brains need a good level of nutrition. They need a good level of hydration, whether you have ADHD or not. Now, obviously, someone with ADHD is struggling a little bit more with their attention, so it's maybe a little bit more important. But I'd be saying this message across the board to any young person I'm seeing.
Yeah. Goodness me. Well, so when people come and see you, probably hopefully with their parents, with the family, how do you help them? How can you start to help them? Because, you know, this problem seems, well, I've experienced it. It's been really quite a difficult problem to get around. How do you start?
So what I do at London Psychiatry Clinic is I start with an assessment. So usually a family will kind of contact and they'll say, I want an ADHD assessment. And usually people are asking specifically for that. So we'll send out some outcome measures that looks at things like anxiety, depression, and ADHD symptoms. I send out information to schools to get feedback from schools on how a young person is there. And then we collate that information and meet with the family. And we do a 2-hour assessment. So I meet with the family together, then I meet with the young person on their own, and then I meet with the parents on their own. And we go through in a great amount of detail around their developmental history, the current symptoms they're having, also excluding or trying to work out if there's other causes of inattention. So anxiety can cause inattention, depression can, thinking about physical health conditions or maybe other neurodevelopmental conditions. So once I've done all of that work and I've pulled all of that together, looked at the outcome measures, looked at all of the other sort of factors that could be impacting a young person, we then make a diagnosis whether the child does or does not have ADHD. And if they don't have ADHD, I will explain why I think they have attention difficulties, so why they're struggling in the way that they are. And occasionally we need to do further tests, like cognitive tests, to see how their brain is working, like what their strengths are and weaknesses. We might want to get further information from different sources. We might want to do a piece of therapeutic work first before making a diagnosis. So it's not sort of the same for everyone, but that's a kind of roughly where we would be looking at.
So there's a lot to it. If there are any worried families, worried parents listening, can you suggest a good resource, you know, for the layman to really have a look at and see if, you know, potentially actually maybe my child does suffer from ADHD and what they should do next, that kind of thing?
So there's lots of good websites. So a lot of the kind of ADHD charity websites are good. I also think Young Minds is very good. I mean, our website has lots of information. So that's londonpsychiatry.clinic. So that's a source of information for families. There's also some quite good books and podcasts as well that I often sort of recommend to families. So I'd be happy to, you know, give you a reading list after the show.
Okay, I can put them on the social media to go along with the show. What about the NHS website? Anything good on that?
Yeah, so I use the NHS website a lot. And again, the NHS website is a really great place if you want to get information about all sorts of different conditions. It's also quite helpful, actually, if we're starting, you know, young people on medication as well. So getting information that, you know, on medication, on ADHD medication. So we would use it for that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Look, I think this is probably very useful, could potentially help an awful lot of people. Well, you said 5-7% of the population of children can suffer from this. So, you know, it's going to help a lot of people. So many thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you, Mike. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some information with your listeners.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Before the next guest, I just want to tell you something that I've been trying out recently and really enjoying. I have a Watt Bike exercise bike, and I've started doing one of their exercise plans. They have an app to go with the bike, and there are various exercise plans on it. And I started doing the Health Beginner 2 training plan. There are 3 sessions a week from between something like 15 and 30 minutes each time. It varies. I've done 10 sessions out of 39. I certainly do feel a bit fitter and with a bit more energy, and I certainly plan to finish the whole thing. I'm also trying to eat a little bit better while I'm doing this. Eat fewer biscuits. That's my main goal. I've done pretty well at that. Since I've started, I haven't eaten any biscuits. I'm also trying to drink less wine. I'm doing okay at that. What I'm trying to do is only drink wine at the weekends, and I include Friday to be part of the weekend. So it's Friday, Saturday and Sunday. I've done that pretty much. I have lapsed on one or two occasions, but generally it's going well and I'm feeling good. I haven't actually lost weight yet, but as I say, I certainly am feeling good. And you can join me on the exercise sessions if you want to. I have a YouTube channel where they are being streamed. It's the Relax Back UK is the name of the YouTube channel. And at 12:30 on Tuesday, Thursday and Friday, you can join me. And you don't have to have a Watt bike. You can have any sort of static exercise bike. You don't have to follow the program. You can just come along for a gentle pedal. There'll be a bit of gossip as well. So come along. It'll be nice. Now, the next topic is it's also about exercise. I've been talking about exercise. So it's exercise and walking habits in general, but also those, oddly, of caravanners. Matt Allwright is my guest. And first of all, I thanked him for finding the time to come and chat.
It's my pleasure, Mike. And it genuinely is my pleasure because I love walking. Me and my missus, we cover, well, as much distance as we can, really, because it's things tend to get sorted out on a walk. I don't know how it happens. It's a bit of magic, isn't it? You know, you set out on the walk and all you're planning to do is go from one place to another. But it feels like while you're doing it, you put the world to rights, and maybe some of the things that you're worried about, you put them into perspective.
That's good. Actually, I have to admit, that is my experience as well. But I have to say, this whole tie-up with caravan owners, I thought seemed quite obscure. So I started to wonder how many Brits own caravans? I mean, are you a caravaner? Is that what set this off?
I'm a camper vanner, and it's a small difference. Obviously, a camper van is a vehicle that you can sleep in and make tea in, and it tends to be quite compact, and that's what I like. I like having my little life support unit that me and my missus can jump into and then go anywhere in the country pretty much and right. Know that when we get back, we'll be able to make our tea, you know, have a cup of tea, whatever it is, and have somewhere to sleep that's the same every night. And I know that sounds kind of weird, but I spend a lot of time in hotels and they're fine, but they're always different. Whereas our van, we know exactly what we're doing there and it's always the same environment. So
I totally get it.
And the thing is, particularly if you're walking, then like knowing that you're going back to the same environment, it's lovely because you don't have to, like if you come in like looking like a shambles, like you've been dragged through a hedge, then you don't have to worry about what people think about you. Whereas in some hotels, you might think, oh, we've got to get dressed for dinner or something like that. So, it's a lovely way of doing it. And the club, the Caravan and Motorhome Club, makes it so easy to get involved in that way of doing things.
Well, certainly most of my childhood memories are in a VW camper van. My mum and dad had one. That was the only vehicle. All our holidays were in it. So I'm on board. I love the whole thing. But not everyone kind of likes caravans. They're the butt of a lot of jokes. And famously, Jeremy Clarkson hates them, doesn't he? Seems a bit unfair.
I mean, he has controversial opinions for money. So that's what he does. And I think what you do is you decide in your life what it is that works for you and the ones that you care about around you. And then you can take people's opinions with a pinch of salt, can't you? Because what I find is when we're with our family in that environment, we are properly with each other. We have each other's attention. Whereas when we're in the house together, we've all got our own rooms and our own distractions. Yeah. And I think it's that combination of really being with each other as a group, and sharing things on that level, and the closeness to nature that makes it right for me and makes it right for the million members of the Caravan of Motivation. Yeah.
And, you know, we're in good company for liking this stuff, because I just looked up how many people have touring caravans.
Go on.
And it's 500,000 in the UK. 500,000 people have touring caravans.
So there you go, Jeremy Clarkson. 500,000 people, exactly. Can't be wrong.
Well, but there's more, because 260,000 have those kind of static caravans, holiday caravans.
Yeah.
And then 164,000 are like you, have motorhomes. So yeah. I think Jeremy is probably in a minority.
Listen, he's got a lovely farm. That's all I can say. you know, and I do think, like, the variety of ways you can do it, like roof tents have become very popular in the last couple of years. It's a great way to get started with the club. You know, you rock up in your car, pop it up, and there you go. You've got a safe and warm place to sleep for the night. But I think this campaign that the club has put together is a really interesting one, because of the way that it's linking, you know, that lifestyle with getting out and about on foot, and the benefits that you get from taking a stroll in nature, yeah, or even in our cities. You know, our cities are great walking places. Manchester is a fantastic place to walk. London, you know, Liverpool, these are all great cities to stroll around, and you're still doing the same job of making your body fitter and your mind clearer, is what I find.
So I must admit, when I was a kid and I went camping with my mum and dad in our camper van, which we loved, we were sometimes a little bit sniffy about caravanners. And I think the kind of idea, certainly of my parents, was that it's far too comfortable. They're trying to create their home elsewhere. And what they do is they take this thing, this box somewhere, and then they just sit in it and watch TV there, as opposed to watching TV at home. So do you think caravanners are sort of active type people, or do they just go somewhere else to watch TV?
I don't know, but I know I'm not in a position to judge them for their holiday choices. I think the lovely thing about whether you're a motorhome or a caravan is, like, nobody's telling you what to do. Nobody's telling you that dinner is between such a time and this time, and that you've got 7 days or 14 days, and then you will be taken on a coach somewhere else. You get to decide. If you want to sit and watch telly, that's what you do, you know, and nobody can tell you that you're doing it wrong, because that's your holiday and you get to choose. And I like that idea of creating your own destiny day by day. If you want to go and walk the hills, that's brilliant. But if the next day that's taking it out of you, you can sit and relax and read, do a crossword, whatever it is. And that's what I'm on board with, is the idea that people, when they, you know, people work hard for their time off, and they work hard to get the money to buy the opportunity to do these things. And I think when you do that, you should have as much freedom as you want. And this way of doing things gives you exactly that.
Yeah, no, very true. Very true. And so we touched on this idea that the Caravan and Motorhome Club are trying to get people to be a bit more active if they want to be. You know, obviously, yep, they can stay in the caravan and play cards and watch telly or whatever. But if they want to get out and about, the caravan club's getting involved. What are they doing?
Okay, it's called the Walking Wanderers Campaign, and it wants its 1 million members, that's the Caravan Motorhome Club's 1 million members, to collectively walk 120 million miles over the course of a year. That is the total length of roads on the surface of the planet, 120 million miles.
Okay.
Break it down, a million members have to walk 120 miles over a year. That's 10 miles a month, which actually starts to sound kind of doable, I think, on that level. But I think even if that goal is unachievable, let's face it, there are people that cannot walk at all, and some people who have limited mobility. The idea is, whatever you are doing, however far you're walking currently, maybe try and walk a bit more and just appreciate the huge benefits that you get from walking, which I'm sure, as UK Health Radio, you know all about. You know, you're talking about cutting the risk of heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, even some cancers. And the benefits it does, you know, you sleep better and your mood lifts, you know, your mental health can be like, I find I feel so much better after a walk. It clears my head and I can just focus and put things in perspective and focus what's on what's important.
No, I agree. But actually, I'm a dog owner. So when we finish here, I'm going to be taking the dog for a walk. So I have to go for a walk every day. It's not really a choice for me, because otherwise the dog gets upset.
Yeah, well, dogs have got it right. I mean, like what gets them more excited than the possibility of a walk? Very, very little. And I think like learning from them and seeing that enthusiasm and just being a bit more dog as you head out is a great thing for everybody, whether you own a dog or not. But yeah. That kind of enthusiasm is infectious, isn't it? You just want to go with them.
That's true. Yeah, no, like my dog absolutely loves it. And this survey that the Caravan has got up to, they looked at some variations sort of regionally about how active people are.
Yeah.
And they were quite surprising, weren't they?
Yeah, it turns out that the Southwest and Scotland are doing pretty well. 62% of adults in the Southwest walk for fun at least once a week. In the Southeast, where I come from, it's only 15 to 25%. And I figure that must be something to do with the infrastructure. That's got to play a part in it. You know, how easy is it to walk along busy roads? Would you want to do that? And then if you get into the countryside, are there pavements? Are there places to walk? So definitely, I think the surroundings and the environment play a part in that. But genuinely, I also think we just get a bit too comfortable in our cars.
I was surprised it was as high as that, actually. So really? I'm in the Southeast. Yeah. And, I think I'm in very much in a minority going for a walk pretty much every day. I was surprised so many people did.
I think it can be a challenge, especially if you've got a routine that involves a commute or like a school run. Then you can find yourself in the car quite a lot. But, you know, trying to replace part of that journey with walking, if you can, is one way to approach it. You know, we're not judging people for what they do, but it's an opportunity, again, to ask questions about why people in some parts of the country seem to like really look forward to a walk or make the opportunity to walk, and why for some people it seems to be that bit more difficult. I mean, London, interestingly, 52% of Londoners walk weekly for transport. So that feels like London is a walking city where it doesn't feel inhospitable or for some reason.
Well, it probably coincides with a tube strike or a tube breakdown or something, doesn't
it? There you go. That's it. Yeah. That's it. But I'd always rather walk than take the tube. I think like the tubes can be very convenient for getting from one end of the city to the other. But if it's like 2-3 stops, I'll probably walk it. I think you just pick up so much more from a city like London. You end up with stories when you walk and you just end up on the tube when you're
No, I think you're right. But in other parts of the country, a slightly different story. So I'm looking at these statistics. Yorkshire and the Humber, not doing so well there.
Yeah, 40% of adults aged 40 to 60 walk for less than 10 minutes a month. I think, you know, it's hard to, without digging down into these figures, really understand why. But then, you know, I suppose there are going to be other pressures on people, maybe a time pressure. You know, if you're working hard, you just feel like the last thing you want to do at the end of the day is go out for a walk on top of that. But it's difficult to know why. Some interesting stats coming out of it, to be honest.
Well, I mean, stats are very peculiar, but I did a little bit of digging myself just before this chat.
Oh, yeah.
And I tried to find out where the highest ownership of caravans and motorhomes is.
Oh, can I guess?
Go on then.
So this is per capita, I take it, is it, right? Derbyshire.
Yorkshire and Humber.
Oh.
Where fewer people walk, more people have caravans and motorhomes.
Oh.
Quite what that proves.
Do you think there's a correlation between the two?
Well, I don't know. That's what I was hoping you were going to tell me as the expert on this.
I will go out immediately and carry out further research to try and establish if that's the case.
I better tell you my source if we're taking this seriously, all right?
Well, then. Yeah.
My source isn't that great. I tapped in something quickly into ChatGPT, where do most people own these things? And that's what it threw up. So we have to be a little bit careful of our sources. But I thought it was an interesting statistic nonetheless.
I've got a source myself here, which tells me that Yorkshire and Humber are the places where the most caravan and motorhome manufacturers find themselves. So that could be the link there.
Yeah, there you go. If there's one down the road, maybe you're more likely to buy it.
Maybe that's it. If you're surrounded by them, yeah, you'll pick up on them.
So lastly, if you're a caravan owner or a motorhome owner or not, yeah, and you want to do a bit more hiking, how can people use this kind of idea that the caravanning club is trying to get challenges all to walk 120 million miles? How can people get involved with it?
Okay, so camc.com is the club's website. There's also a little specific area called which is camc.com/walkingwanderers, which will take you straight to the campaign page. But, you know, as soon as you check into a club site, they'll tell you where the good walks are. So being a club member is a great way to start getting involved with this. And maybe if, you know, going for a walk like that is not your thing, maybe that's one way that you could start trying out something new.
Yeah, no, that sounds like good advice. So look, Matt, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. Much appreciated.
All right. Cheers, Mike.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Hayley Ponsford and presenter Matt Allwright. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears. Beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.